Back together again, you and I chatting it up, wrapping up a very busy week, Friday style, October 3rd, 2025, right here on Connecticut Today. I had full support at the beginning of the show for a Trump White House-authorized U.S. military strike earlier in the day against an alleged narco-terrorist boat operating in the Caribbean. CBS News White House reporter Olivia Rinaldi dropped by later on in the show, live from the White House, with more details about that Trump action against alleged drug cartel smugglers. The Yankee Institute's Andrew Fowler dropped by to talk about his op-ed regarding a proposed state investment in the WNBA's Connecticut Sun. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso joined us with his weekly update, and we wound up the program having a little fun. Thomas Wolfe, the guest, the author of Baseball in the Roaring Twenties, The Yankees, the Cardinals, and the captivating 1926 season.
Well, I guess if you kill the drug smugglers, the drugs won't get here, huh? Hey, how are you? Well, we're just going out and getting them now, which is fine with me. The White House determining, it says, that the U.S. is now in a quote-unquote armed conflict, says here on CNN, with the drug cartels designated as terrorist organizations. Yeah. That's according to a memo obtained Wednesday by CNN. I like this. Blow them out of the water. I'm dead serious here. Mr. Trump has determined that smugglers for the cartels are unlawful combatants. How about that? And therefore, the Pentagon was legally authorized to hit a boat in the Caribbean last month. So we have that, and now that, and now the Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says another strike has taken out four other alleged drug smugglers in what's being determined to be a narco-trafficking vessel. This happened this morning. Happy Friday if you have fentanyl. This is the latest strike on narco-trafficking vessels in the Caribbean Sea. Hegseth saying a Connecticut strike took out a boat connected with a designated terrorist organization in the Southern Command area responsibility. No forces were injured in the attack. The War Department has shared a 38-second video of this whole thing. Now, the latest strike says here, this version from the Hill comes as Mr. Trump declared yesterday, Thursday is what I read in the beginning here, that the U.S. is now at war with drug cartels. Sounds good to me. That are designated as terrorist organizations by the administration, providing legal justification for the prior strikes against those vessels in the Caribbean. Now, a lot of people don't like this. I think this is great. Well, Paul, don't they get due process? Well, if you're trafficking drugs, no. I'm sorry. Well, what if they're fishing? Maybe they shouldn't be fishing there. You okay with this? I am. Let's start off with a little good news on a Friday, shall we? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Now, there are people that say, well, you need authorization from Congress, and you've got to go through a process here. No, I like that. Maybe we'll get fewer amounts of fentanyl in this country. Maybe we'll get fewer amounts of other harsh drugs in this country, cocaine and whatever, if people know that, geez, I don't know, maybe we'll blow them out of the water here. You have any problem with this? I sure as heck don't. And maybe this is just another example of maybe, I don't know, doing things a little bit of a different way here. And I know there are people that are going to say, well, you know, the innocent people could be hurting. Yeah, I guess, but the innocent should maybe stay away from where the drug traffickers operate as well. The White House says illegally and directly cause the deaths of tens of thousands of American citizens every year. These groups are now transnational and conduct ongoing attacks throughout the Western Hemisphere. The White House has determined these cartels are non-state armed groups. That means they're not flagged vessels. That means we're not really attacking anything representing the states of, you know, Mexico, Colombia, Venezuela, whatever. They've been designated as terrorist organizations, and the White House and Mr. Trump has determined that their actions constitute an armed attack against the United States of America. Hallelujah. Absolutely. I love this. Keep it going. Take out more of these drug runners. As long as you know they're drug runners, if they're little pauper fishermen there, then okay, be careful here. I get it. But no one is saying these aren't drug traffickers. Maybe this is the right way to do this. Do you ever think about that? Maybe if we know that there are drugs on that boat, what's the point of, well, you've got to stop them and you've got to get on the boat? No, I'm dead serious about this. Just blow them out of the water. And maybe people will stay away from there. You okay with this? I sure am. And we set that up to be our question of the day today to get us up and underway on a nice Friday, the 3rd of October, 2025. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Do you support military strikes authorized by the White House without an okay from Congress against alleged drug smugglers? Well, Paul, how do we know they're actually drug smugglers? Well, yeah, I guess we are taking a chance on that, aren't we? I guess. Have we screwed up yet? I don't know, but why not? Hey, if they're in a longboat, if they're trying to outrun somebody, and they're on a known path for narco traffickers, take them out. Maybe this is the way you really battle the drug lords. Maybe you do turn it into a military action. Maybe if you find these people, blow them up. 203-333-9422, 333-WICCs. We're up and underway on a Friday. Yeah, so apparently, according to the White House, we've picked off and killed another four what they call narco-terrorists in a narco-trafficking vessel. That comes from the Defense Secretary, or now I guess is he the Secretary of War? I don't know. Pete Hegseth. He said the military killed four narco-terrorists on a boat that was carrying drugs off the coast of Venezuela. And apparently that happened this morning. Hey, there's a happy way to start your Friday. The strike took out a boat affiliated with a designated terrorist organization in the area of responsibility of the U.S. Southern Command. No U.S. forces were hurt. Maybe this is the way you have to do this. How about that? I'm all for this. I really am. Could we make a mistake or two? Yeah. But you know what? Listen, collateral damage. I'm kidding. It's a joke. Relax. But here's my thought on this. If we know, if we have intelligence, which we probably do, if we have certain imaging technologies, which I know we do, and we know there are drugs on a boat heading to the U.S., right? Legal or otherwise, they're probably illegal. Why not just take it out? Why are we going to waste the time and send U.S. personnel there who could be fired on, who could be the subject of retribution? Maybe the drug cartels would take out somebody else in the U.S. forces. Just blow them up. Seriously. The Pentagon shared a 38-second video of the strike showing that vessel being blown up and engulfed in fire. Well, isn't that a little much, Paul? Maybe it is, but I have an idea. My guess is if you stay out of those waters and you're not piloting a smuggling boat at some sort of accelerated speed, you probably won't get blown up. I mean, you know, there are certain things that I guess if you tell people enough not to do, they probably won't do it. Like, you know, you could probably make it from one side to the other on I-95 or on the Merritt or Wilberforce Parkways on foot, but it's probably not a good idea to try. So maybe we can do enough of these, courtesy of the Trump White House, to maybe convince these drug smugglers not to do it. This coming as the White House declared late yesterday, and we'll have a report on this coming up, that the U.S. is now officially at war with drug cartels, designating them as terrorist organizations. Maybe this should have been the idea all along, and that provides legal justification for the strikes. There was a notice sent to multiple national security committees in Congress. The White House saying the U.S. is in a, quote, non-international armed conflicts with designated terrorist organizations. Well, how about that? Maybe we should have done this earlier. I don't know. Seems to work for me. But you tell me, is this a bad thing? Should we, even if we're dealing with accused drug smugglers here, is this the kind of thing where we should ensure due process, quote unquote? Now, do we still do that even though we're dealing with allegedly with drug smugglers that want to import things into this country, including things like fentanyl that could be deleterious to young people and old people alike? The White House says the smugglers illegally and directly caused the deaths of tens of thousands of Americans each year. These groups are now transnational and conduct ongoing attacks through the Western Hemisphere as organized by the drug cartels. Maybe this is the way to go. Maybe you stop playing nice and saying, well, we're going to arrest these people. We're going to give them trials. I don't know. You tell me. If a drug smuggler's boat gets blown up in the Caribbean, do I care? Do I look like I care? I know you can't see me, but envision me caring. You won't. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Question of the day. We begin with this. Facebook.com/voiceofct. Do you support military strikes? Yes. We're using the military, authorized by the White House, without an okay from Congress, thankfully, against alleged drug smugglers. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, talk or text. Maybe if people want to make sure that innocents aren't involved here, maybe those innocents stay away from the known smuggling lanes in the Caribbean. I don't know. The U.S. Central Command would probably have something to do with that. Todd in Shelton opens it up for us today. Todd, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Hi, Mr. Pacelli. You're doing a phenomenal job.
Thank you, Todd. I appreciate that. Always love hearing that from you. What's going on?
You know I'm with Trump 100%, and I've been clean and sober 38 years, and I'm totally against drugs, especially fentanyl. Under Biden, I lost 10 loved ones to fentanyl. Under Trump, I lost none.
And when you were at your lowest point, Todd, did you consider what was happening to you in the country, an attack like the White House does now?
Nah, you know, back then I just worried about, you know, staying alive, and I had to go to the rehab and clean up my act.
Yeah. But you've stayed clean now for how many years?
38 years clean and sober, sir. I buried a lot of people that wouldn't listen. I tried to lead the horse to water, but they wouldn't drink.
Todd, thank you for the call. Appreciate it, my friend. Always good to hear from you. So take Todd's experience there and imagine going through that, whether it's loved ones, whether it's extended family and friends, whether it's people you know at work or in your house of worship, whatever. Maybe this is the way we should treat this. Because, you know, part of the argument on this you hear from the other side, well, you know, these drug cartels, these drug operations, this, that, and the other, well, you know, they only exist because Americans provide a market. Well, wait a minute. So you're blaming, we're going to blame the victim here. That's the way it works. Only because there's a market, we're going to blame the victim. My God. So let me know what you think here. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Yeah, I'm all for this. In fact, I hope the White House and the Pentagon, the Defense Department, the War Department, whatever else they're calling it these days, they let it know to these countries, Venezuela, Argentina, Mexico, El Salvador, No matter where this is coming from, say, if you don't stop this, we will kill more of your people. Yeah, I know that sounds a little harsh, but there's an easy way not to get blown out of the water. Apparently, look, I'm no ace at this stuff, but apparently, if you're not running drugs, you probably have a good shot not to get blown up. We're joined once again by CBS News White House reporter correspondent Olivia Rinaldi. Olivia, good to have you with us on a Friday. Hope everything is well. And never a dull moment. What did Pete Hegseth, Olivia, the defense secretary, what did he announce earlier today?
Well, it's good to be with you, Paul. Yes, there is yet another boat full of alleged drug traffickers off the coast of Venezuela that the U.S. has struck again today. The White House announcing it along with Secretary Hegseth. So this is, of course, continuing, and we learned earlier in the week that the Pentagon had notified Congress that essentially the U.S. is considered at war with what they're calling unlawful combatants. That's the same terminology we use to describe al-Qaeda and other terrorist networks during the Bush administration. So this allows the White House, this administration, to unilaterally use military force against these drug traffickers. Because remember, if they're just calling them criminals, well, then they have to go through a court of law. But if they're calling them unlawful combatants, that allows them a different set of laws in which they can operate under, according to U.S. law, to allow them to use military force. And remember, Congress is the one that has to approve the use of military force. That's called an AUMF, Authorized Use of Military Force. That has not been approved since 2001. Wow. So we are now in 2025 without an authorized use of military force from Congress and an administration acting on their own authority to really tamp down on drug trafficking, seemingly one boat at a time.
And finally, Olivia, is there any indication there when you folks ask anybody at the White House or Secretary Hegseth, hey, how do you know who's on these boats and what, if any, drugs are there? Am I to assume that they throw a lid on that? Are they worried about burning their sources? Or have they given any indication as to how they know this?
You know, that's a good question. Our Pentagon people are probably a little bit more tapped into that. But it seems when we do ask about this from the White House or Pentagon perspective, we normally get the response that they are ardently aware of who is in those waters, what they are carrying, and alleging that they're not, you know, people who are just on a joyride, but saying that these are proven drug traffickers is what they tell us. Of course, getting that information is increasingly difficult. One, because they blew up the boat, but two, they claim it's classified information that we are not privy to. So getting details on this is proving particularly difficult.
Olivia Rinaldi, CBS News. Olivia, thank you. Have a happy weekend. We'll chat down the road. We appreciate it.
You as well.
Thanks, Olivia. Thank you. Olivia Rinaldi, CBS News. You're here on the network here at the top and bottom of the hour, and you see her sometimes on the CBS Evening News as well. A couple of weeks ago, I was chatting off the air. They didn't want to come on, but I did talk with some very nice people from one of the largest state employee unions, AFSCME Council 4, after they had put out a very keenly crafted statement telling Governor Ned Lamont, please do not use any of our pension money to buy a state share, likely a minority stake, so that would be 49% or less, of the WNBA's Connecticut Sun to keep them in the state, keep them from moving. Although anybody who knows pro sports knows that the professional leagues, well, it's kind of like McDonald's and Burger King and Dunkin' Donuts, whatever. They decide where the franchises are going to be. You can't just say, well, we have the franchise and I think I'm going to move here. No, 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 no. But despite that, and despite just 15% of people in a recent University of New Hampshire survey saying they support it, the governor apparently is still trying to do this. I don't know whether it's a feel-good, fuzzy thing that he knows is never going to happen. Maybe the scab of losing the Whalers is still there. I don't know. A lot of people writing about this, including our next guest, who's with us a lot from the Yankee Institute, communications specialist, columnist, researcher, Andy Fowler here. Andy's got a piece in Real Clear Books and Culture, realclearbooks.com. Check it out. Connecticut should pass on investing in the sun. Andy, it's Paul. Good to have you back, my friend. How are you?
Doing very well, thanks. It's very good to be back.
Thanks, Andy. Appreciate it. Is Ned Lamont serious here? Do you think, look, the guy's an extremely successful businessman. He's worth a few hundred million bucks, by all accounts. Andy, is he serious, do you think, or is this just kind of a, well, I'm going probably into a re-election campaign. This will sound good, and I'll back off on it. Before we get into the numbers here, what do you think is the governor's motivation here?
I honestly can't speak to that, but I mean, past a few years ago, he tried to persuade the Arizona Coyotes, who are an NHL franchise, yeah, to relocate to Hartford. So I would say, you know, he seems a bit of a sports nut, mm-hmm, you know, and also putting that Connecticut is the basketball capital of the world, which being a UConn alum, it is.
Okay.
But suffice it to say, is this a wise investment? No, I would think that, you know, we're at a point of where we just had our great credit ratings upgraded.
Mm-hmm.
We're moving in, you know, the right direction in terms of stabilizing state finances and also funding our pensions. But we're still well below the national average for how much for our funded pension system. And as you know, Paul, probably, you know, Yale did that study, I think it was about a year or two ago,
yeah,
that said that the state lost billions from underperforming investments. And if we just had returns that matched the national median, taxpayers would be $5 billion richer. So is this wise? I don't think so, because once again, it risks undermining the fiscal guardrails, which have, again, stabilized Connecticut's state's finances. And it's that's the game plan, right? If you're a sports, you know, if you're a coach, mm-hmm, you'd want to stick with the game plan that seems to be working, and the guardrails, yeah, are working, right? And so why use that still precarious funds to buy into a basketball team? Because that just seems to echo past mistakes, and I think it would undermine hard-won credibility and undermine the fiscal guardrail.
Yeah, and I wonder, Andy, if any thinking here has changed, because as I mentioned, the union came out, and you probably saw the statement,
right,
they put on Facebook and said, no, please, not with our pension money here. So, you know, that happened, and again, Connecticut has an extremely strong state treasurer's position. And unlike some other states where some of these investments, Andy, are done by a board on a majority or a two-thirds thing, from what I understand, Eric Russell is the guy that has to decide this. Now, would he be pressured? Probably. But just those things, what the union is saying, Andy, and how much power Eric Russell has, kind of makes this, I would think, not possible. But who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if it is just, trying to show that, you know, we're, you know, for the governor and the administration, trying to show voters or people of Connecticut, like, you know, we're trying to, uh-huh, keep this state, trying to keep the team in state. And, you know, the WNBA has skyrocketed in terms of ratings, attendance, franchise values. But the problem is the league has never turned a profit since its inception.
No.
So
no.
And what this would do is that, you know, there would be some revenue in some places, but the real payoff would come if Connecticut eventually sold its stake, minority stake in a team.
Yeah.
Which would once again expose the team to relocation. So it's a little bit like, why would we even do this? But I want to just make it clear that, you know, public subsidies for stadiums has been common mm-hmm, for decades now,
yeah,
but a direct government ownership of a franchise is,
no,
is very rare. And again, the Connecticut has had a poor pension investments. And so this just screams of, why are we risking a good thing? We're trending in the right direction because of the fiscal guardrails. You know, we've had our multiple credit upgrades,
yeah,
rating upgrades, which, which eventually, which increases investments and would help lower taxes and save hundreds of millions of dollars in the long run. So, why would we risk this to buy a team that could potentially move again in the future?
Exactly. And the investment strategy, Andy, and Andrew Fowler is the guest from the Yankee Institute. Strategy is obviously you invest pension funds into stuff that you know is going to appreciate. You know, Apple gets richer and richer. Tesla gets richer and richer. You know, people still buy Campbell's soup. I mean, that stuff is what people are going to use. What happens if the state, Andy, in an investment situation, okay, they buy into the Connecticut Sun. Maybe it's not a majority ownership. But then what happens if people just don't go? What happens if the team is bad? There's no ticket revenue there. They're not selling what they projected in merchandise, in collectibles, in food and drinks and beverages. Then what happens? Is there pressure then? Does the state start leaning on the team? Hey, you got to make up that revenue, hike the soda and the beer by a dollar a piece. You know what I mean? I mean, there's all kinds of intangibles here that you're right. It just doesn't, it doesn't make sense. And again, long term, it could hurt the fiscal stability that we have.
Right. And also, one of the stipulations is that, that the team needs a new practice facility, which could cost over $100 million.
Yeah.
It's like, what are we going to do? Bond that? That has real budget implications, not only just for, the short term, but long term as well. So, how much of the taxpayer dollar is going to be invested in this team? And is it worth it? It would be disappointing to lose the Sun.
Sure.
I'm not advocating that they do leave, but we have to remember that fiscal discipline has to come first, especially from a government perspective. This should be left for private investors.
And finally, Andy, we just and I know this is part of the push here, but we just dumped, and God bless the building. I went to a gazillion concerts there and Whalers games. But we've just spent $150 million, I think, renovating what used to be called the Civic Center and the XL Center. So we're even extending ourselves there because we're caught in a rock and a hard place. It's like, well, the thing is still usable, but to bulldoze it and build a new arena in a city where demographics are changing is a several $100 million proposition there as well.
Right. I mean, and also this also, at least let's hope the roof doesn't cave in like it did in the late 70s, right?
Oh, my God. I remember that.
But there are real affordability issues at stake here. You have high housing, energy costs, mm-hmm. high taxes, a slow growth rate. Truth in Accounting just came out and said that Connecticut has a fiscal health of an F, 49th out of 50th in the country. So it's. We're not in a position to just spend willy-nilly to invest in things that are at risk. We have to invest the pension funds into things that are will actually grow over time and actually will turn a profit. Which at this point, the Connecticut Sun, that just doesn't seem to be reality. We need to be focused on fiscal discipline and making lives more affordable here in Connecticut.
The title of the piece, Connecticut Should Pass on Investing in the Sun, Andrew Fowler from the Yankee Institute. Check it out, realclearbooks.com. Hey, Andy, thanks. We'll be in touch down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Appreciate it. Andrew Fowler there. Check it out. Yeah, we love the team, but I mean, it just, this is, doesn't make sense. And I think the governor realizes that. I understand that, but he can go out there on the campaign trail, say, you know what, folks? At least I tried. All right, one of my favorite segments of the week. A lot of people say, hey, is Caruso on this week? I said, absolutely, to talk about all things Hartford and Bridgeport and all that. Chris Caruso joins us. Chris, how are you, sir? Everything good?
Very well, Paul. How about yourself?
Chris, I'm living the dream, and it's too late for law school. So what the hell else am I going to do?
Right? Exactly.
What am I going to do? Chris, before we get into the nitty-gritty here, we want to remind people of the parade, of course.
Yep.
And also, you sent me the flyer regarding the annual military concert. So what's up with those?
Well, the parade, Paul, is our 117th Greater Bridgeport Columbus Day Parade. We're the oldest in Connecticut for Columbus. probably I would say New England. The next parade is New York City, but that began in 1929. So ours is 117 years old. We have over 100 units that will be marching in the parade. It starts at Jewett and Madison Avenue in Bridgeport, goes south on Madison, all the way down past Michelizzi's, Italian Ices, and will end up at Central High School, where we'll have the Feast of St. Francis. The feast day for Francis is October 4th, so it coincides nicely with Columbus Day. And we're asking everyone to come out. Whether you're Italian or not, come out, enjoy yourself. It's a great parade, very multi-diverse parade. Mm-hmm. We'll have people from the Latino community will be involved. We'll have youth organizations, bands. It'll be just a great parade. So come out and enjoy it. And as I mentioned last week, you are our honorary Grand Marshal, so you'll be in the parade with WICC. And we want everyone to come out and say hello to you and just have a great day.
Yeah, looking forward to it. And, Chris, I know you sent me the annual, and we'll get into this a little bit later on in the month, but sure. We have those military concerts coming up at the Klein, correct?
Yep. Yeah, we have two of them, Paul, October 10th and October 11th. This is our 36th year bringing in the Marine Band, and it's really a crowd pleaser. People seek to go to this. They hear about it. They want to be there. Get your tickets. You can do it online at our website, CIASGBPT.com, or you can go to Nick's Diner, 2200 Madison Avenue, get the tickets there, the North End Library up on Madison Avenue, Port 5 Naval Vets, or the Klein Memorial itself. And it is a free concert, but require tickets based on the capacity. You could fit 1,400 in the Klein, and every year it reaches about 1,300 people.
Wow.
Come out. And this year, I will tell you that they installed an elevator because it was always hard for people to get up to the balcony. So they've installed an elevator. People can go right in. It's handicapped accessible. And enjoy the concert.
Excellent. Now to some of the nitty-gritty. Love to get your thoughts on this. Chris, yes. Now he still hasn't said he's running, but a couple things with the governor here. This Costa Diamantis trial, which, of course, is connected to some alleged, let's be fair here, alleged bribery and funny business with school contracts. The defense wants the governor to testify here. You think he'll do this? Is there any advantage for Ned Lamont to take the stand here or not?
Well, I doubt, to be honest with you, and I don't have any proof, but I doubt Ned Lamont was involved in any of this alleged corruption. And it could just be the defense bringing someone in just to make a show of it in some ways. But I really doubt. I've known Ned Lamont. I've backed him for office in the past.
Yeah.
I just doubt very, very much that he would have been involved in this or complicit. I don't see that. So, again, it's maybe a move by defense to heighten the attention and to bring the governor in to answer questions. But whether the governor will accept that or not, I don't know. He could be subpoenaed and required to come in. We'll have to wait and see. But again, you know, the defense, the plaintiff in the case, has to do everything possible to prove their case. That's their right. And, again, it may just be a flashy thing to, you know, you announce the governor as a witness and everyone says, oh, my God, what happened? It may be nothing, you know. I think we have to wait and see.
Sure. And according to that, and, Chris, I love polls. I think they're good snapshots. And any politician, Chris, who says they don't read the polls is lying. You and I both know that.
Sure.
Because it's free research. Now, the governor, according to this University of New Hampshire poll, he's at 54% approval, which to me is about right. That doesn't astound me. But the other figure there, Chris, that was interesting, only 43% said they want him to run again. Should he be concerned with that 43% number or not?
I don't think so, Paul. You know, it's early, and I don't think the governor should get the paudes, you know, an Italian nervous. Take it easy. It's still early.
Calm down.
Exactly right. Keep in mind, you have a Democratic primary possibly happening with Josh Elliott and the governor.
Mm-hmm.
That may fizzle. You have a primary that's going to happen with the Republicans. So until you see who the candidate would be against the governor, anything is possible. You know, one of the Republicans of the two may win the primary, and then the people say, well, you know, we like that person, but guess what? We like Ned Lamont better. He has a good proven track record. So I think it's early right now. 43% isn't bad, though, because I think he can build on that.
Yeah.
And 54% in Connecticut, favorable for a governor, is very good. You know, we've had governors much less than that. So I think he's going in a good position right now, but we just got to wait and see and let the timing, let it all work out, and we'll see. You know, once everything shakes out, once the primaries are over, you know, you may see, for example, the Democrats, if the Republicans are strong, you know, people may say to Josh Elliott, hey, it's time to back out. Let's get around the governor. You don't know. So it's early right now. We've got to wait and see how everything shakes out.
One other thing as far as shaking out, Chris, and this is supposed to come in the next couple of weeks, again, after a timeout, what is the Connecticut Siting Council going to do regarding these UI monopoles? There's a big rally set for this weekend. People still are not happy. And, you know, we've heard from UI, and the power company said, well, yeah, we could bury the poles, but it's going to cost an extra, bury those lines, we should say, go with no poles, $700 or $800 million. You know, Chris, it seems to me, and maybe with your experience, you think otherwise, I don't see any, it's going to be like a baseball umpire. 50% of the people, half the people are going to be upset, you know what I mean, with whatever they come up with. What are your thoughts on that?
I think, Paul, it's good that there's going to be a protest. I encourage that, as long as it's peaceful. You know, environmental protests are part of the U.S. history. I remember in Bridgeport when we fought against the two asphalt plants being built. We won that at a zoning hearing. Over 1,300 people came out and let their voices be heard. So I encourage a peaceful protest that, you know, spells out the reasons why you're opposed to something. I think that has an impact on the commission. They'll probably see it. They'll read about it. And you never know. May think twice. So I think it's important that they come out. And I think it also says to the utility companies, there are alternatives that they have to be thinking of. They don't want people coming out and protesting. That's never good for their company. So they have to look at the alternatives, whether putting the wires underground or some other proposal that makes it more acceptable. You know, recently, Paul, you saw that Marissa Gillette is resigning, right? And the last hearing that she didn't sit on, because she had committed that she wouldn't sit on a hearing because she was resigning, and the utilities insisted. Well, the utilities came in roughly $113 million increase in percentage-wise in their rates. They ended up getting about $26 million, okay? And even William Tong, the Attorney General, who many times through his office, you know, speaks on these issues, said that there were a lot of unanswered questions in the proposal by the utility companies and about compensation of their executives. So, you see, she was tough, and she held people accountable, utilities, holding them accountable, and we've lost that. And so I'm just worried where it goes from here, you know, and same thing with the Siting Council.
Yeah.
These groups are set up to protect the ratepayer, to protect the consumer. And if they don't do that, then we've got to make changes accordingly.
Yeah. Chris, I know you still have some influence in Hartford. People have told me that. So listen, the governor says he's having trouble finding people to serve on the Pura board. Can you call him, Chris, and tell him that, you know, I will end my radio career, and for $200,000 a year plus benefits, I know nothing, Chris, about utilities, but I'll take the job. How bad could I be, Chris? Honestly.
Hey, Paul, you could do it. And, you know, the salary is paid by the utilities, by the way.
Yeah.
It's not government. And the interesting thing, Paul, my first couple of years in the legislature, I was on energy and technology. And I have to say, honestly, I got through it very difficult, very complex.
Sure.
At times it was like watching paint dry or watching grass grow. And I would sit there and say, what am I doing here? Because They brought all these engineers in, all these...
Hey, you have no idea what they're talking about.
And I'm being like a chooch. I'm sitting there. So the next session, I quickly got off the committee and got on committees like environment that I enjoyed. But it was for those 2 years, it was a great learning experience.
Yeah.
I learned a lot, but it was a very complex
issue. Oh, yeah.
But Paul, I think you can handle it.
Oh, so mod on.
If you want me to put a good word in, I will do that. You know,
I'll just sit there, Chris, and go, Cavones, all of you, stop this eat, just shut up. All right, Chris, have a good week. We'll talk.
You too. Take care.
Thanks. Take it easy. All right, Chris Caruso there. Back at it as we wrap up another very busy week right here on Connecticut Today. And yet we've spent a few days talking about and screaming about all the bad things. How about we talk a little baseball now that the postseason is upon us? And our next guest is the author of Baseball in the Roaring Twenties, The Yankees, the Cardinals, and the Captivating 1926 Season. Thomas Wolfe is the guest. Hey, Tom, it's Paul here at WICC. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Paul. Always happy to talk about baseball.
Yeah, why the 1926 season? Tom, we hear so much about the 39 season with the Yankees, the Black Sox of 1919, the 27 Yankees, the 61 Yankees. There are all these storied seasons. Why 1926?
Well, that's a good question. 1926 appealed to me to write about for a couple of reasons. For one reason, it's right in the middle of the decade of the Roaring Twenties, so that there was so much going on in the country. It was just a very vibrant time. It was a decade fueled, I think, by reckless optimism and relentless ambition and rebellion and gambling and risk-taking. So it was a very vivid and colorful era to write about. And the 26th season in particular really highlights the two franchises, the Cardinals and the Yankees, in terms of where those franchises were headed in the next 21 years. From 1926 to 46, 21 World Series were played, and 15 of those were won by either the Cardinals or the Yankees. So it's kind of the beginning of that Yankee-Cardinal dominance in baseball. And the one other thing I would say is that what 26 appealed to me because it was a collision of two great careers, mm-hmm. Roger Hornsby of the Cardinals and Babe Ruth of the Yankees, who played against each other in this World Series.
You know, Tom, in reading a lot of books like yours and listening to old radio broadcasts and really getting into documentaries about this era, I don't think any modern-day baseball fans, Tom, especially young ones, can wrap their arms around just how popular baseball was back then. I mean, to a lot of folks in the country, there was horse racing, basketball was almost non-existent, there was some boxing, but baseball was the American dream and pastime, wasn't it?
That's absolutely true. It's America's game, and it's the national pastime. And as you note, it was the team sport that everybody followed. And it had a lot of fans who even couldn't get to ball games because of radio in the 1920s. The fan base was expanding. And so there were constantly new fans being brought to the game. But it was a totally different era for the players as well. Baseball was different in the way it was played than it is played today. The corporate influence is different. The travel was different. And, of course, there was the white major leagues and the Negro leagues, which were separated by segregation.
Did the Negro leagues at that time, Tom, did they get any real media coverage? Only now are we starting to include the Negro League legends and the all-time records. But how was the coverage of the Negro leagues back then when, of course, the major leagues were the king?
Yeah, well, basically there was a white press and a black press. And Negro leagues were covered very extensively in the black press. In cities like St. Louis and Chicago and New York and Baltimore, where there were baseball reporters who reported daily on the games and players who were in the Negro leagues. There just wasn't any crossover between the white media and the black media at that time. What we have now today, though, are a lot of people who have gone back, historians who have gone back and captured a lot of the stories from the Negro leagues and written biographies of the major players and studied the leagues and the history of black baseball in America, which goes back, just like white baseball, it goes back to the mid-1800s.
Thomas Wolfe is the guest. Baseball in the Roaring Twenties, the Yankees, the Cardinals, and the captivating 1926 season. Talk about for my listeners, Tom, how captivating was this? How encompassing was this for America, that 26 season, and some of the highs and lows and storylines we had there?
Yeah, well, probably the big storyline, I mean, related to the Yankees, is that it was a rebound year for them. After being in the World Series for several years after they acquired Babe Ruth in 1920, in 1925, the Yankees finished seventh, 28 and a half games out of first place, and Ruth had his worst season ever. So going into 1926, the Yankees and Ruth were both written off as has-beens, and that really contrasts with the Cardinals, who were kind of on the ascent. Rogers Hornsby became the player manager for the Cardinals in 1925, and so he was leading a pretty good team into the 1926 National League pennant race. And in a comparison between the two players, between Ruth and Hornsby, there was just no comparison. Hornsby was a far, far better player in 1925 than Ruth was. Hornsby hit .403, Ruth hit .290. And, you know, in fact, Hornsby led the major leagues in batting average, home runs, and runs batted in. He was the big star for the day.
You also mentioned here that there was a lot of attention paid to Major League Baseball becoming a darling of the White House, but it wasn't necessarily Calvin Coolidge, the president at the time. It was his first lady, his wife and first lady, Grace. She was big into the game?
Oh, she was big into the game. She was a student of the game. She really understood baseball. Calvin Coolidge is probably the dullest man we've ever elected to the presidency. I mean, his years were relatively calm in terms of the country, but he was not passionate about sports. He and his wife were probably about as opposite as a couple can be in a successful marriage. She was a terrific Senators fan, and the Senators won the American League pennant in both 1924 and 25, and then later, when she and Calvin moved back to Boston, she became a Red Sox fan. She was a Red Sox fan really for a longer period of time than she was a Senators fan. And she, American League honored her by giving her a lifetime pass so that she could go to any game she wanted for free for the rest of her life after she left the White House. She was a terrific fan.
And finally, Thomas, obviously you talk about the big stars in the book of the 20s and that 1926 season, but is there a name or two in there, maybe not a top-level star that everybody goes, oh, yeah, about, but somebody that you highlight, the people should know about, maybe kind of a B-plus level star from that era, Tom, that really doesn't get the accolades he should?
Well, I'll mention one name, and people will recognize the name, but I don't think they have recognized what a great player he was. And that's Grover Cleveland Alexander, mm-hmm. who was had a terrific career, first with the Phillies, then with the Cubs, and then was considered kind of washed up because he had personal problems. He had problems with alcohol. But the Cardinals brought him on board, traded for him in the 1926 season, and he became the pitching hero of the 1926 World Series. He won two games and saved one, all in Yankee Stadium. He's really the hero of that season for the Cardinals. And his life story was made into a movie, which people should check out. It's called The Winning Team, and it stars Ronald Reagan as Grover Cleveland Alexander. It's really, really worth seeing that movie.
The name of the book, Baseball in the Roaring Twenties, the Yankees, the Cardinals, and the captivating 1926 season, as the postseason of Major League Baseball this year is finally upon us. So grab this for the weekend, folks. Cleanse your palate from all the politics and all that as we move forward. The author, Thomas Wolfe, has joined us. Thomas, thank you. We appreciate it. And we'll chat down the road, I'm sure. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. It's been great.